This is Dana Lombardi with the War College here at Celesticon. Our next speaker is going to do his second talk. Jack Green is going to be talking about why World War I became World War II and some of the things. Some of the seeds, and also what you've figured out or learned, including some alternative possibilities and so forth. And like I said, all of this will be up on the website within a month after the convention is over. So you can go there, listen to the ones you did not get a chance to hear, and also tell your friends about it, because that will help draw more people in future years if they hear what we've been talking about here and they find it interesting. Are you getting a... Oh, okay, there we go. All right. Go right ahead, Jack. Thank you so much.
Okay, so this is going to be a little bit different talk than one that you get commonly. I want to take you behind the curtain. I want to talk about some items that you will probably not see on the History Channel on the war. Much of what happened in World War I came back on World War II on steroids. The strategic use of submarines, death camps, ethnic cleansing, weapons of mass destruction, and new ones at that. Poison gas being the most prominent in World War I. So we will look at these with a backdrop of Hungary and sometimes starving Imperial Germany and Austro-Hungarian Empire fighting for a fading political order. I'm not really going to discuss the Versailles effect. To me, the Great War is an excellent example of the failure of political leadership. And I think we could probably add military leadership as well. Because of the nature of a lot of the stuff I've been reading recently in terms of Fleet Admiral, and I'm the type of person that if I'm reading something and something catches my eye, then I follow it up. So at a certain point, I realized that the 1907 German election for the Reichstag, or would that have been right back then?
Reichstag.
Was critical to the political order and thinking that went into the beginning of World War I. A lot of the election for 1907 for Germany involved the war going on in German Southwest Africa. That's your color printout that you have. And to give you a sense of perspective, if you look at German Southwest Africa and then take your eye up to where the Iberian Peninsula is, that's actually pretty proportional. In other words, the German Southwest Africa is substantially larger than the Iberian Peninsula of Spain and Portugal. So that kind of gives you a sense of size. Now, granted, a lot of it was desert, and it was certainly not heavily populated. But there was a revolt that began in the very late 1903, which I understand now it's politically incorrect to say a Hottentots. But the Hottentots and the Herero, and I'm probably mispronouncing this, but that was the first group that rebelled, and then the Hottentots. And the Germans had to go in to put down this colonial rebellion and restore Germanic order in German Southwest Africa. And one of the key political issues in the 1907 election was German imperialism, German colonialism, and it was sort of, in some ways, a miniature Vietnam, if you want, just because the numbers were exceedingly small. It's considered to be the first genocide of the 20th century. There have been previous ones, but it's considered historically to being the first genocide that took place in the 20th century. Okay, now. We talked about earlier, and for those who weren't there for it, much of Europe then, and certainly to a much lesser degree today, had a very strong class orientation. If you were born to a baker, your dad was a baker and your mom was a housewife or something of the lower class, so to speak, you were probably going to end up for the rest of your life in the lower class. And this was not just in Germany, not just in Austro-Hungary, it was throughout most of Europe. And probably you could almost say all of Europe, with maybe the possible exception of France. So one of the things that the Kaiser and the whole German political structure was trying to do, and to a degree also in Austro-Hungary, was to combat social democracy, the SDs, the social democrats. The idea that they did not want to have socialism, they certainly did not want to have a homogeneous, classless society, was what a lot of the old order was battling. And one of the issues that the old order used, and the old feudal order used, was, for example, colonialism. This is great for Germany. We need to promote this. Well, now, if you look at your other sheet, you see the election results between 1903 and 1907. And the critical factor is that the other thing is there was an element of proportional voting. And voting was done in Germany on a state-by-state basis. So, for example, the way you voted in Prussia was completely different than the way you voted in Bavaria. So in the case of Prussia, they had stacked it in such a way that there were three tiers of voting, which was designed so that essentially if a lot of people were voting for social democrats, their votes were less equal. And actually that became a crisis issue within the German government during the war. That was one reason, I'm going to mispronounce his name, the Chancellor Bethlen Hollweg. Yeah, he was one of the reasons he got kicked out is that one of the things that he said, we got to do some reforms here, and the entrenched older feudal order that was running Germany, Ludendorff, the Kaiser and such, the Crown Prince especially, no, we're not changing. Look at your third party on this list, anti-Semites. I mean, here is a party that ran under the name of the anti-Semites. It's interesting, if you go on Wikipedia, because I tried to come up with some more information about it, and even in this book on the election of 1907, there's not a whole lot of discussion of it, and they've increased their vote. But, I mean, it's hard to conceive of a political party that ran on a platform of being anti-Jewish. And this is in 1907. Now, this wasn't, you know, execute Jews or anything of this nature. It's much more. It was almost like the way the Gypsies are today in a lot of Europe. I would argue they're not truly German. So the social order of the day was based on your birth and not so much your talent. And one of the lasting legacies of Bismarck's success in 1864 and 1871 was that the German Constitution gave almost a free hand to the Kaiser in military, naval, and foreign policy. In the course of the war, his power would erode. The 1907 election had a Reichstag that would support aggressive military, naval, colonial, and foreign policies. And that's probably one of the critical results of this election. And what the author of this book said that I got a kick out of is that it was absolutely such a successful election. He goes, apparently the German people were, by this time, more chauvinistic than their government, which is kind of an interesting concept. And now here's another one that's often missed, is the Constitution in Germany, Imperial Germany, limited legally the army to no more than 1% of the population could be active military. So there was a built-in level that the German army could not expand beyond, or was in violation of their own constitution. Okay, so let's look a little bit more at this Jewish aspect of Central Europe. You could not be an unbaptized Jewish officer in the German army or navy. If you were a Jew and you were going through an officer program, you had to go through baptism to become an officer in the German army or navy. This is not true in Austro-Hungary. Austro-Hungary is probably the most open to Jewish officers of all the European countries, certainly France and Russia. I think Russia doesn't have any. But you also have, in the case of like in Austria, the longtime mayor, Karl Luger, who died just before the war, was known for his anti-Semitic rhetoric. And He also liked a Frenchman who founded the Anti-Semitic League in France in 1889. Hitler later saw him as an inspiration. And he's also most famous for renaming Budapest as Judapest. Yeah, no, I mean, it's just amazing. He in 1887, he voted for a bill proposed by a longtime opponent of his to restrict the immigration of Russian and Romanian Jews. So this underlines a lot of what's going on. Now, we talked about Field Marshal Conrad in some of the earlier talks, both mine and Dana's, who was the head of the Austrian army for much of the time before and during the war. By 1916, Marshal Conrad, who became a hero to the Nazis, I believe you pointed out, well, part of the reason was because he said, you know, this multi-language and multi-nationalities we have in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it doesn't work. We should all become Germans. And so by 1916, Field Marshal Conrad was advocating, along with other Austrians, what would eventually be the Anschluss in 1938. On the Austro-Hungarians, here's just some data. Between 1885 and 1914, the Prussian army trained more than 30,000 Jewish officer candidates, but not a single candidate received a commission. Like I say, in the Navy, they were at least, if you became baptized, they would allow you. The Russians, it was virtually non-existent. French and the British, it was negligible. Now, in 1897, Austro-Hungary, a census revealed 1,993 Habsburg Reserve officers who classified themselves as Jewish. I mean, it's a remarkable difference. There's an old saw that a lot of the Jewish families actually had a portrait of Franz Joseph in their homes, because I think part of it was because Franz Joseph and the whole Austro-Hungarian Empire did not want to promote nationalism, because they were riven by various nationalities within their country. And the Jewish population saw this as actually an avenue of being somewhat inclusive. Now, the Jewish population in the empire was 2.1 million out of a total of 52 million, according to the 1911 census. By 1911, the number had dropped a little bit, but it was still 1,871 officers, or 17% of the officers were Jewish in the Austro-Hungarian army. Now, the Kaiser Wilhelm, was pretty open to Jews until the revolution in Russia. By 1917, he had an officer who was working with the Bolshevik government trying to, you know, bring about a peace treaty between them. And he noted the number of Jews in it, and that's when apparently the Kaiser really switched gears. He'd had some of the big industrial families that were run by Jewish families the Kaiser had been close to, but apparently in 1917, when there was such a large number of Jewish people in the Soviets, that there was a change. And if some of you aren't familiar with it, the Kaiser would make notes constantly on everything that came across his desk. And many of these notes still exist. You know, this is wrong, this officer's an idiot, or yeah, this is right on. And this is where some of the notation came, was when this officer was reporting the paperwork's coming across his desk, and it was like, this may have been where there was a fundamental change. Okay, and now another critical factor leading into World War I, which was also brought up earlier today, was the Balkan Wars. And yes, the Ottoman Empire was the sick man of Europe. If it's sometimes forgotten, that Egypt was still technically part of the Ottoman Empire. It stretched from Yemen to Basra. And of course, Russia wanted to control the Bosphorus. And what we have to understand, if you see a map of how quickly Europe changed between 1911, because that's when Italy and Turkey went to war over Libya, and Libya and some of the Dodecanese Islands, Rhodes in particular, ended up Italian, that the Balkan War broke out, and a lot of the European section of Turkey was whisked away until it was just the rump that was left in Europe. One thing that's missed is that somewhere up until, I think this is as recently as the 1960s, 1960s, Usually 80 to 90% of the leadership in Turkey came from European Turkey. Their ancestors from Salonika, from Macedonia, who were essentially forcibly evicted. And this is like one of the early, the winners write the histories, right? One of the things we sometimes don't realize is that there was tremendous movements of population in 1911, 1912 in the Balkans. I mean, if you were a Turk living in Salonika, and Greece was now running Salonika, you were on your way to Constantinople. And the Balkan powder keg, I think, lived up to its hype. Now, one of the other things that came up earlier was that Field Marshal Conrad was constantly arguing for war against Serbia and Italy, even though in the case of Italy they were still allied with them. And he wanted to crush them while they were still weak or small, and that he felt that the Austro-Hungarians might have a good chance of crushing Serbia or throwing Italy back and maybe even recapturing Venice back from them. And he was constantly going to Franz Joseph arguing with, and of course, up until July of 1914, he finally got his wish. But here's another little gem that I found in researching this. The yearly maneuvers, and this was true both in Germany and Austro-Hungary, they were based on false assumptions, the military maneuvers. Okay, what do I mean? Well, neither Germany nor Austro-Hungary realized that the endurance of their troops was more demanding and they did not provide enough for logistical support. So it was real easy to say, okay, you normally maneuver maybe with a corps each, or it wasn't like the entire army was mobilized and going through these practices, but they would set up a scenario that would be acted out by the officers in command to see what would result. And what was happening was that they would do, and then they would stop and they say, okay, well, let's say that within 2 days, our troops are over here. And at the end of those 2 days, we'll have another scenario that will, or part of the scenario will be playing out at that point. Well, what both Conrad and the Germans were failing to realize is that what they were doing in large part on paper and moving pins on maps did not translate into what the troops could actually do. So one thing, especially if you read about Conrad and some of the Austro-Hungarian maneuvering, 1914, 1915, 1916, it's sort of like, well, such and such corps should be at this point by now when they're going to be back here. For logistical reasons, marching conditions, enemy action, I mean, there's just all sorts of different items that were monkey wrenches that were being thrown into the machinery of their armies that they just didn't really fully realize. And this is, I think, applicable to virtually all the European nations. Okay, now let's turn just to massacres that took place during World War I. Okay, I think we all know about the Armenian massacres. 3,000-year-old people were marginalized. There was first a pogrom in the Ottoman Empire in 1894-1896. And between that and what took place during World War I, probably 1 million, maybe as many as 1.5 million Armenians ended up dying. Now, they weren't necessarily moved into camps and physically killed with firing squads or such. They were starved. They were sent to camps. They got diseases. They died. And there are some reasons for the forcible relocation. It wasn't because they were Christian. It was because they were anti-Ottoman Turk, and that the Russians actively supported them and tried to arm them when they could. But one of the groups that's usually not mentioned is the Assyrians. The Christian Assyrians in the Ottoman Empire probably lost approximately 1 million people. And they became an extreme. Armenia at least has a nation today. The Assyrians do not. Interestingly enough, I was completely unaware of this. And then about, 12, 14 years ago, we had an Assyrian who, family background, who came to work for us at my soil and geology company. And, you know, kind of working backwards, I found out that the Assyrians, especially in the Mesopotamia, Baghdad area, had gone through the same thing. And in that case, the British had tried to arm them. And, of course, the Greeks. I think we all know about the Ataturk and the post-war World War I attempt of Greece to basically control both sides of the Aegean. And the end result was that the Turks kicked out all the Greeks if they didn't kill them by the end of 1922. Now, it's interesting that Armenians are across the planet. Apparently, there's about a million Armenian background people living in Russia and living in the United States. And of course, we all know our ex-governor Dugmajian is Armenian background. Okay, so let's turn to Belgium and atrocities there. Between August and September 1914, 6,000, mostly men, but women and children too, were killed by German troops in Belgium and France. 15,000 to 20,000 buildings were destroyed, the most famous being the German, the Belgian town, Louvain. It was burnt, looted. Its library of ancient manuscripts was burnt and destroyed, as well as Louvain's university, along with other public buildings. The citizenry of Louvain was subject to mass shootings, regardless of age and gender. This wasn't like, oh, we're going to go out and kill Belgians. No. What would happen is, first of all, remember the Germans hadn't really fought a war since 1871 at this point. And if there was a stray shot, maybe by a sentry who was nervous or whatever, it was, oh, there was a guerrilla, a Franc tireur, a legacy of the 1870-1871 campaign where the French peasants basically shot at German troops. There was a feeling that this was going on. In the case of Louvain, there's an argument been made that there were some retreating Germans who came into the garrison where the Germans were garrisoned there, and there was some exchange of fire, and that was the spark that led to this. But it goes on. In 1914, Belgium had 260,000 businesses. By 1918, it had 3,103 businesses. Its economy had been devastated. By 1917, 106 iron and steel factories had been shipped out of Belgium to Germany. Streetcar systems were literally removed from Belgian towns and French occupied northern France and moved to towns in Germany. When Ludendorff and Hindenburg came to power, 180,000 workers were forced to move to Germany from Belgium. 85,000 Belgians during the war would be killed or died, and a lot of it was because they were starving along with a lot of Germans. And it was more than the Belgians lost from soldier losses. So there were more Belgian civilians killed in 1914-1918 than were killed in the fighting. Occupied northern France saw the population go from 2.25 million to 1.6 in 4 years. Now, part of this was because at a certain point, Switzerland stepped in and said, look, you send us a train with old people and children in it, 500 at a time, and we'll get them routed from northern France into France via Switzerland. So there was a large number that were shipped via Switzerland's efforts. Now, by no means are the Central Powers the only guilty members here. Russia shipped 800,000 aliens. By an alien, by Russian definition, was a Romanian, a Cossack, a Pole, a Jew, and plus they shipped 1 million Russians, and of course many of those died in the process.
Where did they ship them to?
East. they were in a war zone, or it's like a Russian corps of infantry traditionally was allowed to have 2/3 Russian, ethnic Russians, and 1/3 non-Russian, be it Finns, well, not Finns, it wouldn't count, but Estonians, Poles, Ukrainians, and that was, you know, sort of like, that was a pre-war formula. Britain did the same thing in India to a degree. They would always say that you could have two battalions in a regiment that were Indian. The third battalion would be British, and of course the British controlled the artillery. So, but that's a legacy of the Sepoy Rebellion of 1857. So let's talk a little bit about internment camps and concentration camps, because yes, the Germans used them in Southwest Africa in 1904, 1907, both against the Herero and the Hottentots. But they were used by the British in the Boer War. The Americans used them in the Philippines during the Philippine Rebellion. Of course, the Spanish used it in Cuba. But it seems that the first modern use of concentration camps, which are still used today, you can call them what you like, but they're trying to keep the guerrilla away from the citizenry that are going to supply you, was used probably by the French in the early 1890s in Vietnam and dealing with rebellions there. That was one of the first real use of it. Of course, when anything is a success or deemed as a success, it's picked up by the other militaries. So the role of Ludendorff, and I think we all know that Ludendorff accompanied Hitler during the Munich Putsch. And Ludendorff, he's an interesting character. I don't know enough about him to really come to a real conclusion about him, other than that he was very much of a nationalist. He advocated in May of 1970, he wanted the army enlisted to read patriotic articles, and this ended up going to the Navy. And if I mentioned earlier in my talk, there was a naval mutiny in 1917 in one of the dreadnoughts of the German Navy, and that one of the upshots of that was to try to control that, was that they started reading these patriotic articles on board the ship to see it, and it's a lot of the commentary. You don't have a lot of post-World War I memoirs by seamen in the German Navy, but you get the sense from the sailors that who have written that this was an opportunity for some of the guys to go to sleep when the readings were taking place. Ludendorff also wanted to declare war on Austro-Hungary in 1918 because the Austro-Hungarians were seizing food that he thought should go to Germany. On average, can I assume that everyone knows about the turnip winter in Germany? The blockade against Germany grew to such proportions that tens of thousands, usually sick and elderly, perished because of lack of food, and that's called the turnip winter because they were eating turnips. And of course, this was Perfidious Albion's blockade of Germany, which was leading to this. Well, horse meat became upscale, and in 1918, the average weight of an Austro-Hungarian soldier was 120 pounds. Now, I grant you that they're height and stature were smaller than what we are used to today, but that kind of gives you a sense. Now, at the start of the Grand Offensive by Germany in the West in 1918, their best divisions were getting 2,500 calories a day. In 1914, it was 3,200 calories a day. And if you read anything on food and war, I did a talk last year on it. It's critical. And I think that kind of gives you a sense of just how the blockade and how the war had changed. Almost one German died every minute for 1,586 days. Now, as Dana pointed out, most of them died in August of 1914, or a great deal of them, but that's just a staggering number. In fact, one of the outgrowths of the whole turnip winter and the starvation was that Hitler was firm in World War II to make sure that the German people were fed. And there's a great line by Goering, Air Marshal Goering, he later put it, "People in Europe may starve, but they will not be Germans this time." Okay, so, just as an aside, I forgot to mention this. If you'd taken the German Navy in 1905 or 1906 and said, oh, we're not going to build dreadnoughts and we're not going to build battleships. We'll just build a few cruisers and some submarines and some destroyers and left it at that. The number of men who served in the German Navy were the equivalent of two German Army Corps. So you war gamers out there, you can take that one to the bank. So by 1917, you had the foreign minister of Austro-Hungary writing, if the monarchs of the Central Powers, and by the way, this is what I think 1917 is the critical year. If the monarchs of the Central Powers are unable to conclude peace within the next few months, and this was April 12th, 1917, then the people will take it over their heads. And then the waves of revolution will sweep away everything for which our brothers and sons are still fighting and dying today. So there's the foreign minister of Austro-Hungary. Monarchist Germany's share in the October Revolution reveals the secular explosive force of Germany's will to power, which not only sought radically to transform the previous form of the Russian state, but did not even shrink from pulling down the existing social order at one point in the enemy world. And let's face it, the Russian Revolution was kind of the start of the whole revolutionary period that took place in 1917, 1918, and extended on into the early 1920s. And for that matter, you could make a good argument that what happened with the fall of the Tsar in some ways led to Mussolini's rise in Italy. So, just to give you a sense of how entrenched the feudal order was in Germany, the inheritance tax was passed in 1913, and this really upset the entrenched old order. This was like, I don't know what would be comparable in American politics, but it was just maybe introducing a sales tax in the state of Oregon. Or not not Oregon.
The national income tax in 1916.
Okay, fair enough. So, are we familiar with Wolfgang Kapp? Kapp, the Kapp-Putsch attempt right after the end of World War I. Well, Wolfgang Kapp, who, by the way, was born in New York City, and the family, turned out Kapp's, I think it was his father, might have been a grandfather, had been on the barricades in 1849 and moved to New York, and then the family went back when Kapp was, I think, 7 or 8, maybe 10. But he joined with Alfred von Tirpitz, Tirpitz of the Navy, who was no longer in charge of the Navy, and they formed the Fatherland Party, the Deutsche Vaterlandpartei, in which Kapp briefly was chairman. The membership of this group, which quote-unquote was apolitical, they didn't run people for the Reichstag, they actually outnumbered the size of the Social Democrat Party. They had at one point, and this is 1917-1918, over a million members. And it was people from this group that would eventually represent the German right in Germany, extending into the 20s and the 30s. You know, there's a lot of talk today on World War I and how there was a lack of war aims. Well, actually, as the war went on, the war goals, especially for Germany and Austro-Hungary, and I mean all the powers had them, grew and grew. And here's a quote that I like in particular. The calculus behind war aims was simple. The more that war cost in blood and treasure, and the longer it went on, the greater the clamor for post-war gains. In October 1914, the British aimed to seize the German colonies, either to neutralize the Kiel Canal or hand it over along with Schleswig to Denmark, and to give German Frisia to Holland, as well as demanding indemnities. So, if you study what the Germans dictated for peace with Russia in 1917 and 1918, it was essentially Ukraine to the Crimean Peninsula were to be detached from Russia, and of course Baltic coast as well. And a lot of it's because of the blood and treasure that had been lost. It was like, we've got to have something from this war. One of the, I believe this is a German minister, he pointed out that generals had profited handsomely by selling produce from their estates to the army, that they acted as middlemen in purveying other provisions to the armed forces, and they routinely recommend only certain friendly firms for military procurement. So there was a lot of patronage and corruption. And it was by no means a monopoly of the Central Powers. The Zimmermann message, which the Zimmermann message, of course, was Germany notifying Mexico that if they came into the war against the United States on Germany's side, that they would get parts of Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico back. No question about that. And the British intercepted it, translated it, and timely let it be reported to Washington, D.C. just before America's declaration of war. Well, one of the Germans, and this, by the way, the Zimmermann message was 1 week after resuming unrestricted submarine warfare, which was, as I mentioned earlier, after 6 months we're going to win the war, so shoot, let's do it. We don't care about the United States. Berlin bankers joked that the most lucrative business prospect was to start up a spittoon factory. 30 million spittoons. That would meet a pressing demand because of the entire Volk wants to throw up. And that was, again, shows that the German populace, and for that matter, any of these European powers, it's not a unified, monolithic, lockstep marching group. There was dissent. Through all this stuff, it was just a question of the size of the dissent and how it got expressed and where it would come from. And then a fellow who wrote a book on the German naval industry, he towards the end has a really poignant comment. In 1917, all appearance of reality and rationality seemed to disappear. One by one, the last few German leaders who kept a tenuous grip on the progress of the war fell by the wayside, defeated by the blind ambition of excessive nationalism and blind hope. So, let us review. Germany in World War I wanted to dominate Central Europe from Denmark to the Bosphorus, Middle Europa. Third time was a charm. Germany is the number three top exporting nation on the planet, and unlike the United States, number two exporting nation, there's not a whole lot of wheat crop being exported by the Germans. And I would argue that Germany today dominates the EU. Essentially, they've achieved one of their chief goals that they had before the war. USA went to war over submarines, and in World War II and any future war would sink enemy merchant ships without hesitation. So essentially what we fought for in World War I, we practiced in World War II. One of the things that's in reading Holger Herwig's study of the German Naval Officer Corps is that both within the German Navy, because the German surface Navy spent so much time in port, it was a lot of the dissension, which led to mutinies, was because they weren't doing anything. And, you know, the brothers and sisters were, well, the brothers were fighting and dying, and the army was involved, and the Navy wasn't doing a whole lot. And it also made them disliked by the German populace. It's sort of like, why aren't you breaking the blockade? You know, why are people dying in the turnip winter? And apparently, and I can't, I'm going on what I read, I don't know enough German background to say conclusively, but apparently the scuttling of the German fleet at Scapa Flow in 1919, because it was considered a dramatic act on the part of the German Navy, apparently regained some of the esteem that the German Navy had before the war. It was lost during the war. Armenian, Assyrian, and Greek massacres were large in World War II on an industrial scale. Ethnic cleansing starts with the Germans in Poland, with the Japanese in China, and of course the Soviets at the end of the war displacing entire populations from Eastern Europe to elsewhere. Now, gas was not used in World War II. Nuclear weapons were. But if we'd invaded Japan, it's pretty conclusive to, from my study of the end of the war, that we had vast stockpiles of poison gas in the Pacific theater, and it was most likely would have been used in the Japanese mainland, especially when Allied troop losses started to climb. In fact, I'm not sure of the date, but about 15, 20 years ago, one of the large stockpiles was still extant in Australia, and they were trying to figure out what to do with it. But I mean, if you think about it, for a massive invasion of Japan and the massing of chemical weapons, that would have taken place. As to the German Navy, Admiral Scheer's chief of staff at Jutland was the admiral who organized and recruited the officers for the new Weimar Navy in 1919-1920. And one of the things that can be said after the Navy was redeemed after Scapa Flow scuttling was that, this is a quote, two decades later, when the Naval Corps went out went once more down to the sea in ships to fight another war, there was no dissension over social status or politics marred the harmony within the ranks. I mean, that's one of the fundamental changes, I think, in Germany and from World War I and World War II, is that the rigid class system had been broken. And then, of course, the German commander-in-chief, Adolf Hitler, made sure of that, that there would be harmony. Now, here's an interesting comment. In 1912, I'm just going to throw these two notes out. In 1912, the Kaiser informed some of his admirals that if he was ever in the position of his grandfather in 1871, his first demand would be the surrender of the French fleet. And I always wonder if this might have been a seed to Churchill's attack on the French fleet in 1940. Because I'm sure Churchill was aware of it. And finally, I have a view of one of the most democratic admirals in the German Navy, General von Mueller. And he came from a common background. He had no nobility, but he was ennobled by the Kaiser because he became an admiral and he was a powerful man and he had the Kaiser's ear. And he was a court admiral. On a visit to the United States, he complained that the first social class was not sitting in Congress, and there might even be a labor foreman in Congress. Oh, my God. Officers in the Army and the Navy often had common roots. And he says, only the American diplomats found Mueller's approval. And what's funny is the fellow officers considered Mueller a liberal, if not a Democrat. So anyway, that's pretty much it. Any questions? Comments?
I've done a lot of recent study of the Weimar Republic for a Call of Cthulhu game that I'm running. And it seems to me that a lot of the predatory things happening in Germany in the 1920s were based on the Treaty of Versailles conditions. You know, the whole economic circumstances with repayment of
reparations,
and also predominant, you covered it pretty well, but the upending of the Tsar in Russia basically caused all the monarchies of Europe to fear for their own heads, and the abdication of the German ruler at that point in time, the German monarch, and then the institution of a Weimar democracy, which basically enabled the fascists and the socialists to go at each other in the political arena, led to a whole bunch of attempted coups of cities in different areas, as you mentioned, the naval mutinies, etc., and a whole bunch of basically ethnic cleansing or political cleansing of the German state. But also, so basically the nominal head of government of Germany being up for grabs because it was a democracy, quote unquote, but also the fact that the Reichswehr was its own entity and wasn't really controlled by the Weimar Republic. So you had this fascist a fascist military that was rogue, wasn't really controlled by the Weimar Republic, and could basically back up the fascist forces within Germany to cleanse the socialists and anybody else that they didn't like throughout the 20s.
Well, I don't know about the 20s, but the one thing I would say is you've got to put everything in the background of the Great Depression. I mean, when you have just, you know, tremendous percentages of your population without any work, I mean, the United States had issues, Scandinavian nations had issues, Germany certainly had issues. And it's just like with the Great Recession that we've just gone through here. I mean, it made some of our own social issues a little bit more raw, I would argue. There's no question it's a very complex situation in Germany as elsewhere, and I'm by no means an expert on it.
I would just throw in there that particularly the kind of lack of governmental control of the Reichswehr, and they're basically being a military that was under the control of the military echelon, but not answerable to the democratic rulers of Germany, left them a lot of power to back certain groups and not back other groups, and it's proven through Hitler's assignments during those late teens and early 20s periods. And so they were able to prop up the fascists within their society, and it's proven that thousands of socialists were purged.
Well, the German army clearly was not in favor of socialism.
Right.
I just clarified.
No,
you referenced a law restricting the size of the German army
to
10% of the population. Are you referring to the Bismarckian Constitution?
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding of it.
That was active duty. That was active at any one time. They could have many more reservists.
Mm-hmm. But the point was is that the number of guys that they could have in the army was apparently in the Constitution, the Imperial Constitution, as I understand it, 1%.
The standing army.
Yeah.
Right.
So is that how they got around it?
Yeah, because otherwise they had a huge reserve force, and Germany was going to use their reservists in a way that at least France thought initially was not possible. Because France wasn't going to use their reservists that way, not the Germans. There's very little difference between the quality of the reservists and the regular army in Germany, where that was not true in the French army and other armies. Anyway, I was going to say that a lot of people forget that Germany surrendered or basically did the armistice, however you want to define it, in World War I, but their army didn't stop fighting. It kept fighting a civil war until 1922.
Yeah.
The Freikorps,
Freikorps.
I mean, Germany is having this warfare going on. Their population is still suffering, and so I agree with you that they were more likely to support the fascists, but that was true of any army because they're conservative by temperament. All military institutions. I mean, you had the same situation in the American Civil War.
The former Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Anarchy going on in Germany in the post-World War I situation with a democracy on top of it and a fascist military president.
Well, very conservative. I think that a lot of them, it was easier for them to support fascism.
Right.
Then it was chaos. I mean, any army does not like that. Any conservative does not want to have chaos. And so if the fascists are going to provide that, then I can see them backing it. But at the same time, remember the German army was trying to get rid of the Nazis and trying to kill Hitler. And it was actually, they were looking for a reason to overthrow him in the beginning, hoping he would stumble in the Sudeten and then, France and Britain.
The sleepwalker.
Yeah, I mean, so It is not true that all the army was behind that, but certainly they had issues, and the first thing they were going to do was in the Civil War. They wanted to get that over with, but they were restricted how big they could be and all these other issues that Germany wanted to rebuild. Interestingly enough, Germany repaid all that debt from the Versailles Treaty. They finally, I think it was in 1990-something, they finally paid it all off.
Is this true?
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we made them pay.
Yeah, it was the 90s or 2000s.
I read an article and I thought it was interesting. They said there was only 12 years during which they did not make babies.
You can guess which 12 years.
Yes, it was the 1,000-year right.
Yes, that 1,000-year
yes. Yes, right. So, you know, it is... It's a really wild west situation, but one of the things you also have to remember is that there's no tradition in Germany at that point of obeying civilian leadership. So the democracy is a brand new concept, right?
Right.
It's like,
one could say it was a power vacuum.
Yeah, I mean, Japan is probably the bigger aberration. Okay, I can understand Germany society not adopting or adapting to democracy right away. Japan was just very much different. There was more of a democratic history there, despite the fact the emperor was still, the titular head. And then the army had to go and assassinate these guys in order to take over in Japan. Well, it wasn't necessary for the army to assassinate all the social democrats and everything. They marginalized them and so forth. But there was no huge history of a democratic, society in Germany.
I would agree, and I would say that they were also in a power vacuum situation and a borderline civil war.
Right.
In post-World War I.
Well, and remember, how many of these guys are writing in the American Civil War? Union generals writing about taking over the country as a dictator. McClellan was bragging about it. Hooker said it, right? Lincoln heard about it, and he said, I can tolerate you as dictator as long as you win the war. So here's a democracy, a country that was on civilian leadership with generals during the Civil War, again, a perceived crisis, right, saying that, what we really need is a dictator here to take over this country and stop this whole mess. And I don't think they're saying it as a joke or anything else. I think these guys are either semi-serious or, would have been willing to do that. And again, a lot of that has to do with a more conservative attitude about things, and I think that's natural. They like order, they like discipline, they like don't like chaos.
Almost standard fare for a big-headed general when you're going to get rough, right?
Exactly. And one of the things I never talked about this during World War II is I always wondered about. Oh my God! It's his nickname was Jesus Christ himself.
MacArthur?
No. That was his initials were G H S H. Oh my God! I can't remember his last name. This is terrible.
Where do you find?
Thank you, Lee. Jesus Christ himself, Lee. Okay, who was the head of logistics in Europe? He did not listen to Eisenhower. He did what he damn well pleased. I could never figure out why this guy was able to get away with this. It's like he wasn't listening to Marshall. He wasn't listening to Eisenhower. It's like, why did you fire this jerk? Eisenhower specifically said, stay in England, right? He moves his entire headquarters to Paris, takes over the best hotels. It's just totally a screw-up, right? It's part of the reason why our armies can't advance, because he's not doing his job properly and disobeying Eisenhower. And Eisenhower is whining to Marshall. Can you make this guy, can you make me do this? And Lee's doing, he's just like thumbing his nose, right? Okay, so where does this come from? I really believe that Lee had information that there was a plot in the army to overthrow Roosevelt during the Depression. I think
there was some discussion. That's pretty much the story.
I think MacArthur and some of these guys, not Eisenhower and not Marshall, but there were guys in the military, again, conservative people, who looked at Roosevelt as a socialist, as a Bolshevik. That was going to destroy American institutions, and the only way they could save America was going to be by throwing him out, basically a coup. And Lee had this information, right? He had some evidence, and so that's why all the guys on the air are like, no, we don't need that. You want to go to Paris, have a good time, thank you very much.
Okay? J. Edgar Lee?
What? J. Edgar may have had this information too, but the bottom line is that the guys in the army, of which Lee, who became the head of logistics in World War II, was able to get away with this.
I'd also just throw in that Ludendorff was a chronic nationalist, and he may have advocated for the invasion of Austria-Hungary because the Treaty of Versailles banned Austria-Hungary joining with the Germans.
he had a lot of issues. Even the Nazis got tired of him sort of marginalizing him. I mean, this guy under attack. Now it's 1918. We're losing the war. Let's declare war on our allies.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's like there's a point where there's just unreality that seems to intrude on all these guys, and you wonder what.
One of the things I didn't really go into here, and I don't understand the full ramifications of it, but when Ludendorff and Hindenburg came into power, and they, and I guess in pursuit of glory, that's when you go from limited war to total war. They had some incredible, unrealistic expectations. The German Admiralty comes to them and say, we can build X number of submarines. It was physically impossible to build the number of submarines that they were talking about. And Hindenburg and Ludendorff, do it. There were several other examples like that where what they thought could be done. And it gets back to, I think, in some ways, that little comment about Conrad and the Germans and maneuvers before the war, where it was real easy to move pins on the map. It was like getting the troops that were on the Eastern Front after the collapse of Russia and the establishment of the Soviet Union. They could get them out of there, and they didn't need a lot of troops to garrison areas and control areas, and they could get X number of bushels of wheat from Ukraine to the German people. Well, they couldn't. The rails, the trains, I mean, everything was
But they were
chaos.
Really getting to the Western Front, essentially, right?
Well, imagine mutiny. There were troops that mutinied and refused to go. It was just Germany was having serious problems even at that point. I think Jack is right about 1917 being a pivotal. We know that it ended in 1918, but I think the turning point, that breaking point, was 1917.
Yeah, if they made peace 1916, 1917, we might still have kings in
right.
Some of the big countries.
Such a big social schism between largely the socialists and the fascists. Being present because of the Russian overthrow and the German war machine losing its legs, essentially, it's natural that kind of anarchy and infighting would occur. Wikipedia gets a really bad rap, but I would recommend for anybody interested on this topic the Wikipedia timeline of the Weimar Republic page. It's very informative.
Yeah, it's lost, obviously, because it's between World War I and World War II, and that whole period is they're discredited. One other thing about maneuvers, the German cavalry in 1914 was god-awful. It was just terrible.
Lancers!
The British just beat the British cavalry just beat the crap out of them, and they didn't do very well in the German advance on Paris, okay? One of the reasons for this is horses chew ground up really badly. So when they were trying to do maneuvers, right, you could have guys tramping, and they usually stayed on roads, and occasionally go out in the fields, but, they were cautious because you're destroying people's property. Horses just devastated areas, okay? And so what would happen is these guys, these big landowners and these upper-class guys and even the burgermeisters, they would say, no, we don't want the horses doing this. And they complain to the Kaiser and the general's dad, he would say, well, okay, we don't need to do that. So the horses all the cavalry divisions never really worked together in operations and maneuvers. So they had no practice, right? It was like they had some theories, but again, the cavalry, like many of the nations, attracted the nobility and the upper class. And it's like, these are the guys who brag that they don't read books, okay? So these are the ones just, we'll go out there and be brave and I'll pull my sword and we'll succeed. It's like, there's no practicality here. So the Germans go out there with these cavalry units of like three divisions with no infrastructure, no core structure, no staff, no logistical backup, and they don't have the extra weapons and all the other things. And they get chewed to crap, and they don't do anything for the German army in terms of reconnaissance and all the other things they need. It's like these few aircraft are out there doing everything because the German cavalry divisions have never had any training together.
Speaking of maneuvers, so at the beginning of World War I, the Austrians had a small air corps, and Conrad, to his credit, had advocated, I think in 1913, that the Austrians should have 1,200 airplanes. I mean, think about that number in 1913. So what few aircraft the Austrians had, they were flying them out, and they basically the Austrians had to issue orders to their own troops not to fire on any airplane because they were shooting down their own.
Yes.
Yes. It's like, who was that?
I always enjoyed the fact that there is a bureaucrat in the Allied side deciding that the best thing they can do to identify the aircraft is to paint a target on it. Okay? So it's like, what mindset is
that?
Is that
the British symbol?
And the French, they're all around there.
And the Italians.
Italy, Belgium, and all that. And the American inherited that. You know, it was like.
They're all around.
So they're all around, you know, concentric circles. And it's like, okay, aim here, right? It's like, okay. And you know why the Germans changed? You know, they had the Maltese cross, which is the points, right? The reason they changed that is when it's up high enough, like 10,000 feet, the eye, the human eye, connects the dots. So it ends up being a circle to your vision. Mm. So German anti-aircraft are like, bam, 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 bam. And the Germans are saying, why are you shooting at us? Can't you see the cross? You had a cross? Really? So the Germans in 1970 go to the Balkenkreuz, which is, you know, the straight, no points, right? So this is an X. Do not shoot at the X, right? But even so, even in World War II, we had the same problem. And there were a lot of friendly fire incidents with aircraft getting shot down. I think one of the most famous ones, it was actually talked about in a novel, Piece of Cake, where they had gun cameras on aircraft, you know, and so you could replay these later and teach your pilots to do things. So they had these British pilots during the Battle of Britain, and they're showing these, you know, these aircraft gun camera things, right? And they show it go by, and this is a Hurricane's gun cameras, and it just chews the crap out of this airplane. And they're like, yeah, yeah. They're all cheering, and then the guy slows it down to like click, 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 and it's another Hurricane. Mm-hmm. Okay? And they're like, it's like, okay, boys, don't shoot your own side, right? I mean, this is basically because they get so excited, you've got fractions of seconds to identify these other aircraft, and it's like, what do? Well, when you're in doubt, you pull the trigger, right? It's like, so there were incidents that happened like this all the time. And it's just interesting to me. It's fascinating because there's all these things that impinge on people's decision. I agree with you, Jack, the lack of reality. But you know what? At the same time, even though they're saying build 3,000 U-boats, right? That same thing can be accused of Franklin Roosevelt, okay? Because he says we're going to build 50,000 airplanes a year, per year, right? And all this Marshall and the other guys are going, man, this guy's really on some drug, right? No way. And we did it. We did it. But he had an industrial base. And the United States had the ability to create factories out of nothing, get the people there, and just, you can see the pictures, all these things where you have a factory that stretches for a half a mile and it's got like 100 B-24s lined up, all getting manufactured. Well, we're the only ones that did that. Nobody else could do that. Soviet Union couldn't do it. You know, Germany couldn't do it. And it was unprecedented.
Wait a second, man. You should have Soviet Union didn't build factories out there.
Yes, it did, but not on that scale.
Like that.
No. Stalin said this himself. He said, you know, America is the land, is the country of machines.
Yeah, and...
He was saying, America's building 10,000 airplanes a month. He said, the best I can do is 3,000, right? He says, you guys are winning this war.
On that topic, I would say two other things, which one of which is, it's a documented fact that the Germans had a secret deal with the Russians to build German armaments in Russia.
Before the war.
Before World War II. And... also, that you know, the Allies are well known for giving all. The United States gave a whole bunch of war material to Russia.
Oh yeah.
So Russia was basically paying with lives, 25 million dead in World War II.
So thank you. And if anyone's interested, I've got a couple examples of some books up here that I've had.
Shameless plug. Wait. Now let's talk about it. Okay, here's his book. Hitler Strikes North. Say it, Jack. Hitler Strikes North. This is about Norway and Denmark. The latest book done on the subject, and it's with your buddy Alessandro Massignani, right? Who's an Italian historian that you've worked with on other projects, right?
Yep.
Okay, now why is this so cool? It's like, okay, it's another Norway book. No, come on. Why is it not just another Norway book? Why is this so good? Go ahead.
Well, for starts, it has a chapter actually on the invasion of Denmark. No one ever talks about Denmark.
That's right. It also has the Norwegian army in here, right? Their organization, everything. You don't see that, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, there's a lot of great maps in here of the battles.
The best book I've done. And the reviews on it have all been good.
Yes, and you've got them here. How much is it?
24 Black Princeton Sea Devils, the Italians during World War II and their basically special forces, and Borghese and the little pig boats that it's not just that, it's miniature submarines and as well as...
All the cool special operations the Italians did in World War II.
And then this is the first one Alexander and I did, which has a lot on the Italians, which of course the Italians get overlooked, or the British.
Even though it does say Rommel's North Africa.
Well,
it was that's right, Jack. That's right. But these are available for sale. You know, I would recommend them if you have any interest in the Norwegian campaign,
special forces,
or the getting the Italian side of the North African campaign. People forget that they had a lot more divisions than Rommel did, and Rommel wouldn't have been able to pull off the stuff he did without their assistance. And the two armored division, Ariete and the Littorio, did really, considering what they had to work with, did pretty amazing.
Yeah, but one of the great stories about the Italians is that the Rommel said, we're going to have a shoot-off. We're going to see who's got the most accurate. And they ordered five German tanks and five Italian tanks to go to a particular site and do a test fire. And the Italians didn't show up because they broke down on the way there.
Yeah. But they would have been more accurate, right? All right. Thank you all very much. You can continue to talk with Jack, yes? And please take a look at his books. I'm sure if you open it up, you'll want to buy them and take them home.